WGTE Public Media in Toledo. This is Storied Ground, a Northwest Ohio history podcast, where we visit our region's many historical sites and markers to rediscover the presence of the past around us in all its wonder, diversity, and complexity. I'm your host, Nick Pavlik. This is part four of our five-part series on the history of the Wyandotte in Ohio, with guest experts Chris Houck of the Wyandotte Nation of Oklahoma.
Hello, my friends. My name is Two Paths, is my Wyandotte name, Two Lives. I am Wyandotte, and I'm of the Big Turtle Clan.
And renowned Ohio historian Mary Stockwell, author of the book The Other Trail of Tears, The Removal of the Ohio Indians.
I'm a longtime resident of Ohio, and I have a PhD in American history. I was a professor for many years at Lawrence University, and I trained with some of the top guys in the American West. So the frontier in the West, to me, is synonymous with America.
In part three of this series, we learned how the signing of the Treaty of Fort Meigs in 1817 marked a major turning point for Ohio's native peoples, as the United States government forced them onto land reserves in Northwest Ohio that were utter fragments of their once vast territories, and tied their future survival in Ohio to their capacity to transform their indigenous societies and take up the agrarian ways of the white settler communities that increasingly surrounded them. We learned of the divergent consequences of the Treaty of Fort Meigs for Ohio's native nations, as they each struggled in their own way to contend with the new American political, economic, and social institutions and environmental transformations that were quickly proliferating throughout Northwest Ohio in the early 1800s. While many tribes such as the Seneca and the Shawnee became deeply unhappy on their land reserves near Lower Sandusky and Wapakoneta and yearned to return fully to the traditional lifeways of their ancestors, even petitioning the federal government to be sent to lands west of the Mississippi River, many of the Wyandotte successfully adapted and flourished on their Grand Reserve in Upper Sandusky, undergoing profound spiritual renewal through conversion to the Methodist faith, establishing a prosperous and educated farming community that left indelible impressions on visitors to the Grand Reserve, and becoming among the wealthiest people in the state of Ohio, with strong economic and social ties to neighboring white farming communities in Northwest Ohio. We learned how changing political tides in the United States eventually threatened to jeopardize everything the Wyandotte had accomplished on their Grand Reserve, as the Indian policy of America's founding generation, which advanced a hopeful vision by which white and native peoples might one day peacefully merge under a shared national identity, gradually eroded under the force of an ascendant nationalistic populism that demanded the forced removal of native peoples from United States territory. And we learned how the election of Andrew Jackson as President of the United States in 1828 became the turning point that would lead to removal being codified as the official Indian policy of the United States. To Jackson, who had run on campaign promises of acquiring more land for the common American settler, the land native peoples in the East continued to inhabit belonged to the United States, not the Indians, and the tribal reserves such as those in Northwest Ohio were tantamount to foreign nations existing within the national boundaries of the United States, which Jackson would not tolerate. In advancing his nationalist argument for Indian removal, Jackson was also motivated by a lifetime of personal hostility toward native peoples, fueled by his memories of engaging in brutal fighting against the Upper Creeks and the Seminoles in the War of 1812, and all the way back to the bloody Indian raids on white settlements he had witnessed during his childhood in the Carolinas. For Jackson, no appeals in favor of allowing the tribes to remain on their lands, no acknowledgement that many tribes had sided with the United States in the War of 1812, no arguments that the tribes were already succeeding on their reserves and simply needed more time to allow for their integration into American society, and no petitions decrying the national shame of such a stark betrayal of the decades' worth of promises the United States had made to the native peoples of Eastern North America, would dissuade him from his crusade to make Indian removal the official policy of the United States.
And I always think Jackson, too, never forgave the tribes for Tecumseh in the War of 1812. He would tell tribes, I know you fought with us in the War of 1812, but you allowed Tecumseh to come to your village. And for that, I will punish you. I think there's a complex reasons in what Jackson was doing.
Jackson now had many staunch supporters in Congress, particularly among representatives of the southern states, who in April of 1830 introduced the legislation that would come to be known as the Indian Removal Act. The bill incited bitter disputes in Congress that generally reflected the divide between the northern and southern states on the question of Indian removal. While the southern states strongly supported the bill, those in the north were intensely opposed to it, with some of the most vehement opposition coming from the representatives and citizens of the state of Ohio.
Ohioans just were against that act. When Jackson first announces this Indian removal bill that he proposes, it's a bitter fight. The outcry in Ohio against it was tremendous. Are you out of your mind? Our two senators voted against it. They said Jackson's a madman. All the representatives who represented land where the tribes had reserves voted against it. It was like 12-2. Only two representatives down in Cincinnati, no Indians down there, a very pro-Jackson area, were for it.
But in the end, Jackson's supporters in Congress triumphed. The bill passed the Senate on April 24th, 1830, by a vote of 28-19, and narrowly passed the House on May 26th, 1830, by a vote of 102-97. On May 28th, 1830, President Andrew Jackson signed the Indian Removal Act into law, enshrining removal as the official Indian policy of the United States. In his second annual message to Congress in December of 1830, Jackson exalted what he claimed to be the mutual benefits of the act for both the Indian nations and the United States, and exhorted Congress to begin the project of Indian removal as swiftly as possible.
The consequences of a speedy removal will be important to the United States, to individual states, and to the Indians themselves. The pecuniary advantages which it promises to the government are the least of its recommendations. It puts an end to all possible danger of collision between the authorities of the general and state governments on account of the Indians. It will place a dense and civilized population in large tracts of country now occupied by a few savage hunters. By opening the whole territory between Tennessee on the north and Louisiana on the south to the settlement of the whites, it will incalculably strengthen the southwest frontier and render the adjacent states strong enough to repel future invasions without remote aid. It will relieve the whole state of Mississippi and the western part of Alabama of Indian occupancy, and enable those states to advance rapidly in population, wealth, and power. It will separate the Indians from immediate contact with settlements of whites, free them from the power of the states, enable them to pursue happiness in their own way and under their own rude institutions. It will retard the progress of decay, which is lessening their numbers, and perhaps cause them gradually, under the protection of the government and through the influence of good counsels, to cast off their savage habits and become an interesting, civilized, and Christian community. These consequences, some of them so certain and the rest so probable, make the complete execution of the plan sanctioned by Congress at their last session an object of much solicitude. Andrew Jackson.
But even Jackson stopped short of incurring the dishonor of explicitly forcing Native peoples to abandon their ancestral homelands in the East. The Indian Removal Act therefore called for Indian nations to voluntarily exchange their lands in the East for new, purportedly equivalent territories west of the Mississippi. The tribes must therefore be persuaded to move west on their own accord.
Believe it or not, if you read the Indian Removal Act, it was voluntary. So technically they didn't have to go. They had to make the decision themselves. But Jackson hired people to go out, negotiate treaties, and do your best to convince these people to leave.
In reality, of course, American officials would pressure Native peoples to give up their lands in the East to such an extent that most tribes would ultimately have little choice but to submit to demands for their removal if they wished to retain their autonomy as Indian nations. But throughout Ohio, many citizens, including those from the white communities situated near the tribal reserves in Northwest Ohio, strongly opposed Indian removal and mobilized in support of the Ohio tribe's right to remain on their ancestral homelands.
So, at least in the beginning, the feeling of citizens of Ohio was, don't do this terrible thing. People throughout Ohio wrote petitions to Congress, the famous ones, the ladies of Steubenville. I was so excited when I discovered that these young women in Steubenville, Ohio, wrote to Congress and said, you can't do this. This is terrible.
To the Honorable the Senate and the House of Representatives of the United States, the memorial of the undersigned residents of the state of Ohio and town of Steubenville respectfully showeth that your memorialists are deeply impressed with the belief that the present crisis in the affairs of the Indian nations calls loudly on all who can feel for the woes of humanity to solicit with earnestness your honorable body to bestow on this subject, involving, as it does, the prosperity and happiness of more than 50,000 of our fellow Christians, the immediate consideration demanded by its interesting nature and pressing importance. It is readily acknowledged that the wise and venerated founders of our country's free institutions have committed the powers of government to those whom nature and reason declare the best fitted to exercise them, and your memorialists would sincerely deprecate any presumptuous interference on the part of their own sex with the ordinary political affairs of the country as wholly unbecoming the character of the American females. Even in private life, we may not presume to direct the general conduct or control the acts of those who stand in the near and guardian relations of husbands and brothers, yet all admit that there are times when duty and affection call on us to advise and persuade, as well as to cheer or console. And if we approach the public representatives of our husbands and brothers only in the humble character of suppliants in the cause of mercy and humanity, may we not hope that even the small voices of female sympathy will be heard? Compared with the estimate placed on woman and the attention paid to her on other nations, the generous and refined deference shown by all ranks and classes of men in this country to our sex forms a striking contrast, and as an honorable and distinguishing trait in the American character, has often excited the admiration of intelligent foreigners. Nor is this general kindness lightly regarded or coldly appreciated, but with warm feelings of affectionate pride and hearts swelling with gratitude, the mothers and daughters of America bear testimony to the generous nature of their countrymen. When therefore injury and oppression threaten to crush a hapless people within our borders, we, the feeblest of the feeble, appeal with confidence to those who should be the representatives of national virtues, as they are the depositories of national powers, and implore them to succor the weak and unfortunate. In despite of the undoubted national right which the Indians have to the land of their forefathers, and in the face of solemn treaties pledging the faith of the nation for their secure possession of those lands, it is intended, we are told, to force them from their native soil and to compel them to seek new homes in a distant and dreary wilderness. To you, then, as the constitutional protectors of the Indians within our territory, and as the peculiar guardians of our national character and our country's welfare, we solemnly and honestly appeal to save this remnant of a much injured people from annihilation, to shield our country from the curses denounced on the cruel and ungrateful, and to shelter the American character from lasting dishonor. and your petitioners will ever pray.
One by one, the tribes themselves had to make the decisions. Do we go? They had a great deal of support, again, in Ohio to stay, which surprised me. It's much more complex.
The passage of the Indian Removal Act was particularly shocking and demoralizing for the Wyandot, who had met and even exceeded every demand of the U.S. government implicit within the terms of the Treaty of Fort Meigs. Not only had the Wyandot survived a state of near decimation at the end of the War of 1812, and within only a few years learned to adapt to a settled agrarian life on their Grand Reserve in Upper Sandusky, becoming successful farmers, educated community leaders, and devout Methodists in the process, they had also gone on to become among the wealthiest and most prosperous people in Ohio, possessing some of the most productive land in the state, and counting business owners, doctors, lawyers, and journalists among their membership. And they had developed close personal, social, and economic ties with the residents of neighboring white communities, some of whom even became members of the Wyandot themselves through marriage. By the time of the passing of the Indian Removal Act in 1830, it seemed unimaginable that the Wyandot could ever be persuaded to leave their homelands in Northwest Ohio. The same could not be said for the other Ohio tribes. Determined to remove the Indian presence from Northwest Ohio and claim the entirety of the strategically important region for American progress, President Andrew Jackson had appointed Lewis Cass as his new Secretary of War in August of 1831. Having served as governor of the Michigan Territory since 1813, Cass was deeply familiar with the histories and traditions of the Ohio Indians and had represented the United States in brokering the Treaty of Fort Meigs with the Ohio tribes in 1817. But he had been a longtime proponent of Indian removal and had even proposed removal to the Wyandot and the other Ohio tribes during the Treaty of Fort Meigs negotiations, much to the astonishment and outrage of the tribes, who refused to even consider such a prospect. But much had changed in Washington, D.C. in the 14 years since the signing of the Treaty of Fort Meigs, and in appointing him as Secretary of War, Andrew Jackson had now provided Cass the opportunity he had long sought to remove the Ohio Indians and complete the total colonization of the state of Ohio. Though the Ohio tribes had once regarded him as a friend, Cass would now become the principal architect of the process by which they would be removed from their Ohio homelands.
Lewis Cass hated natives passionately and made no bones about it.
Cass made clear his position on Indian removal in an article he authored in the January 1830 issue of the North American Review. He advanced a nationalist argument for Indian removal, that a people so fundamentally oppositional to the American way of life simply could not continue to live within the territory of the United States, while also couching it within a professed concern for the long-term preservation and survival of the Indian nations.
The destiny of the Indians who inhabit the cultivated portions of the territory of the United States, or who occupy positions immediately upon their borders, has long been a subject of deep solicitude to the American government and people. Time, while it adds to the embarrassments and distress of this part of our population, adds also to the interest which their condition excites, and to the difficulties attending a satisfactory solution of the question of their eventual disposal, which must soon pass. It would be miserable affectation to regret the progress of civilization and improvement, the triumph of industry and art by which these regions have been reclaimed, and over which freedom, religion, and science are extending their sway. But we may indulge the wish that these blessings had been attained at a smaller sacrifice, that the aboriginal population had accommodated themselves to the inevitable change of their condition produced by the access and progress of the new race of men before whom the hunter and his game were destined to disappear. But such a wish is vain. A barbarous people, depending for subsistence upon the scanty and precarious supplies furnished by the chase, cannot live in contact with a civilized community. The only means of preserving the Indians from that utter extinction which threatens them is to remove them from the sphere of this influence. No change has occurred, or probably can occur in the principles or practice of our intercourse with them by which the progress of their declension can be arrested, so long as they occupy their present situation. Lewis Cass.
Under Cass's sweeping administrative oversight as the official ultimately responsible for carrying out Andrew Jackson's Indian removal policy, throughout the 1830s, American agents would secure treaties with the Seneca, Delaware, Shawnee, and Odawa, forcibly removing them from their ancestral homelands in Ohio to lands west of the Mississippi in Kansas and Oklahoma. The Seneca, living in Lower Sandusky, would be the first to leave Ohio in November of 1831, accompanied by the few Delaware Indians remaining in the state who had been living near Upper Sandusky. The Shawnee, living in Wapakoneta and Hog Creek, the mixed band of Shawnee and Seneca living in Lewistown, and the Odawa, living just to the north along the Auglaize and Blanchard Rivers, would be removed from their Ohio homelands in September of 1832. And the remaining Odawa Indians, living in the Maumee River Valley, would follow in August of 1837 and July of 1839. The terms of the removal treaties with the Seneca, Delaware, Shawnee, and Odawa differed in their particularities, but broadly, the United States had pledged to provide the tribes with large advance payments for the improvements they had made on their Ohio reserves, to use the proceeds from the sale of their reserves to pay for their relocation to Kansas and Oklahoma, and to provide material and financial assistance to help resettle the tribes on their new reserves. Secretary of War Lewis Cass also meticulously devised an administrative system that, on paper, would ensure that Indian removals would be conducted as fairly, efficiently, and economically as possible. American Indian agents were to accompany the tribes on their journeys, arranging for the wagons, ferries, and steamers that would transport them along the predetermined travel routes the agents had mapped out for them, and ensuring that the tribes received ample food and necessary supplies on the long, grueling, and treacherous marches west. But whether the tribes were to be removed west by land or by water, all the bureaucratic and administrative machinations on the part of Lewis Cass for the orderly removals of Ohio's native peoples couldn't account for the perils of extreme weather, the ravages of disease, or the scourges of human greed, corruption, and incompetence on the part of the American agents who had been charged with safely conducting the Indians west. Nor could they surmount the growing indifference of the Jackson administration toward the fate of the diminished and forlorn native peoples of Ohio, who were now seen primarily as impediments to American progress in the East. Nor could they alleviate the trauma experienced by the Indians in leaving their ancestral homelands in Ohio behind. Combined, these overlapping and conflicting realities would mark some of the Ohio tribe's westward journeys with chaos, disaster, and tragedy. In the end, when the beleaguered and suffering tribes finally reached their reserves west of the Mississippi, well over 100 members among the Seneca and Shawnee's already depleted ranks were unaccounted for. Though there is no definitive record of the deaths suffered by the tribes during their forced removals, most of the missing were likely among those who had succumbed to hunger, illness, or the extreme cold during the treacherous overland marches and had been laid to rest along the way, far from the graves of their ancestors in Ohio. After the final passing of the Odawa from Ohio in 1839, only one Indian nation remained in Ohio, the Wyandot.
As time went on and one by one the tribes are leaving, and finally it's only the Wyandot, now you start to get this pressure to leave. The best land is gone. That black soil, yeah, finally you see people on the edges saying it's time to leave. But even then, many people were saying let them stay.
Despite the prosperity they had achieved on their Grand Reserve and the manifold connections they had forged with surrounding American settlements, everywhere they looked, the Wyandot were confronted with the unsettling reality that the unrelenting tide of white settlement in Ohio still threatened to overrun them. While in 1810, there were only 231,000 people living in Ohio, by 1840, that number had exploded to over 1.5 million. And while the Indian Removal Act itself technically could not force the Wyandot off their land, it had clearly granted American settlers license to increasingly disregard the Wyandot's sovereignty as a legally and culturally distinct nation. Between 1825 and 1835, American surveyors and settlers had founded five new towns: Marseilles, Tamakti, McCutcheonville, Little Sandusky, and Wyandotte, around the edges of the Wyandotte's reserves, and nine other nearby townships had been surveyed and opened for settlement. More white settlers were flooding into Northwest Ohio every day to buy up newly opened land and establish their own farms, some of them encroaching onto the Wyandotte's Grand Reserve. Still more came onto the Grand Reserve seeking to rent land from the Wyandotte, or to work as sharecroppers or hired labor on their farms. The Overland Stagecoach route, which connected Buffalo to Cincinnati, now made several stops on Wyandotte land in Upper Sandusky, while the Mad River Valley Railroad, connecting Sandusky and Tiffin, obtained approval from the Jackson administration to establish an east-west line directly through the Wyandotte's Grand Reserve. The pressure exerted on the Wyandotte with the influx of so many new white settlers was exacerbated by the scourge of whiskey the settlers reintroduced onto the Grand Reserve, leading to more incidents of drunkenness, violence, and even murder amongst members of the tribe. Many Wyandotte feared that the promise of the Treaty of Fort Meigs, that Northwest Ohio would fulfill the hopeful vision that American settlers and native peoples could find a way to live peaceably side by side, was unraveling. Since the passing of the Indian Removal Act in 1830, as prevailing attitudes in Ohio gradually shifted in favor of removing the tribes west, and as they bid tearful farewells to their friends among the other Ohio tribes, the Wyandotte had held regular meetings at their council house on the Grand Reserve to decide whether they should enter into removal treaty negotiations with the United States. The councils often sparked heated debate, with just under half the tribe consistently voting in favor of leaving Ohio before it was too late, before the Wyandotte were overrun and enveloped by the further intensifying tide of American settlement, now reshaping the land that had once comprised the reserves of the Seneca, Delaware, Shawnee, and Odawa.
The Wyandottes themselves disagreed, and they constantly took votes, so should we stay or should we go? So imagine that in 1818, they're not going to decide to leave until 1842, when Jackson, again, they're 12 years down from the Indian Removal Act. But in this period, they constantly voted. They had a council house, and they would take a vote. Should we stay? Should we go? The yes would go to one side of the house, the no to the other. It was always slightly more, let's stay. Let's stay. But then there was another group who said, no, we should maintain our traditional ways. We don't have to get swept up in the American experience. We will get swept up in it. And then there were others who said, we got to maintain our legal identity. Once they come and mush us all together, what are we? If we want to remain truly Wyandotte, getting our annuities from the government, having our own laws and our own customs, we need to get out of here. Everybody else is leaving. It's a good thing what Jackson has done. Let's go. And it was always this maybe a 51-52, 48-49 split for quite some time.
But the majority of the Wyandotte still believed they could hang on and resist the increasing calls for their removal among Ohioans. And at each of their councils in which the tribe debated whether to leave or remain in Ohio, the decision was made that they would remain.
The ones who wanted to stay said, look, we're a success. We're educated. We can fight this if they come our way. We have rights. We can remain. They had lawyers in their own families, the Walker family especially. And there's another family called the Armstrongs. The Zanes were big, but they were educated lawyers. They were journalists. They were able to defend themselves.
So when Colonel James B. Gardiner, a rapacious and opportunistic Ohio office seeker, whom the Jackson administration had appointed to implement the removal of Ohio's Indian nations, arrived on the Grand Reserve in the fall of 1831, seeking to negotiate a removal treaty with the Wyandotte, the tribe's leaders were prepared to use their legal expertise to thwart the pressure tactics he had applied in his negotiations with the other Ohio tribes.
There are actually three formal attempts to get them out of the state. The first attempt, 1831, a guy by the name of Colonel James Gardiner, just was an office seeker. He hears the removal act's been signed. Oh boy, I get to Washington, I'll offer my services. I know Ohio, I can get the treaties written. He gets the job. He convinces the Shawnee and in the western part of the state, some of the Ottawa and the Seneca to leave. And then he goes, well, that was pretty easy. It wasn't. But I think he's a bit full of himself, and he makes a mistake of coming over to talk to the Wyandotte at Upper Sandusky. William Walker Jr., this tremendous leader of the Wyandotte, child of Catherine Rankin Walker, he goes, okay, I want to see that land you keep talking about. Let's go out and see Kansas. So Gardner takes a party out to Kansas, and Walker looks at it, and the farther they travel west in Kansas, he said, this is hot, dry, flat land. You've seen the Great Plains. This is not Ohio. He said, there are no trees. There aren't many animals here anymore, and we are such great hunters, we could get rid of them in an afternoon.
We sent parties west to actually look for a place. William Walker Jr. and five or six other men went out a couple of times and looked. They went up around the Kansas City area, and they said no, because one of the things that was big was in about 20 acres, they found maybe 40 sugar maple trees. And they said, this won't do. Sugar was a huge part of our culture.
William Walker Jr., he also looks at tribes like the Osage and the Kansas and the ones out on the plains, and he goes, what do we have in common with these savages? He uses that word. He meets Flathead Indians who come from Oregon. And again, he's amazed by them. He also notices something. He goes, the Americans have Missouri. It's a slave state. He goes, if we come out to Kansas, we're going to be caught in fighting between slaveholders, runaway slaves, people who want free farms. He goes, the Civil War will start here. He predicted Bleeding Kansas about 20 years before it started. So he comes back and he tells the Wyandotte, this is ridiculous, we're not going.
St. Louis, December 15th, 1831. To the chiefs of the Wyandotte Nation. Your delegation appointed to examine the country west of the Mississippi River proposed to be given to the Wyandottes of Ohio beg leave to report that they have, pursuant to instructions, made the examination as directed. The lands between the western line of the state of Missouri and the River Platte are generally prairie, high, dry, and in some places rolling, and in many places cut up with deep ravines, but generally of a rich black soil. In all this tract there is but little timber, and what there is of a low, scrubby, knotty, and twisted kind and fit for nothing but firewood. It has been said that within the scope of this country sugar trees abound. This is a mistake. In all of our examination, we discovered but one solitary spot on which there was anything like a collection of sugar trees, and that was 30 trees on 10 acres. If it be supposed that by removing to this new country, the interest of the hunting part of our nation will be promoted by the abundance of game in that country, we must say it is a mistaken idea. The game consists chiefly of bear, deer, and raccoon, and the smaller kinds of game. We would ask, how long would they continue to be plenty in that region if the Wyandottes got there, particularly as they are acknowledged to be generally good bear hunters. We venture to say that in 3 years' time, they would be as scarce as they are now upon our reservation. Moreover, the leading politicians of the state of Missouri are opposed to the settling of Indians upon her frontier, speak of the Indians as a nuisance and a curse of the state, etc. In short, they invent an unfriendly and indeed hostile disposition. The inhabitants generally upon the frontier of the state, those who would be our neighbors, are, with few honorable exceptions, the most abandoned, dissolute, and wicked class of people we ever saw. Fugitives from justice from the states of Virginia, Kentucky, Tennessee, and other southern states form a large portion of the population upon this frontier. With such neighbors on one side, not only unfriendly to us, but to Indians generally, the Sacs and Iowas view us as intruders. We think the situation of the Wyandottes settled here would not be an enviable one. Missouri is a slaveholding state, and slaveholders are seldom friendly to Indians. At least they have, whenever they have got Indians in their power, proven themselves to be the greatest and most merciless oppressors they have ever met among all of the American population. Situated as we would be upon the borders of the state, our territory would be an asylum and sanctuary for runaway and vagrant Negroes, for as soon as they cross the state line, they are without the limits of the United States. We are sure enough have that class amongst us already. It has been said repeatedly that by removing to this country, we would be freed from the troubles and evils we experience by being surrounded by a white population, especially from the destructive influence of intemperance. We assure you we shall never realize this in that country, On the contrary, we shall have a more worthless and corrupt class of whites to deal and associate with than is to be found in this part of Ohio. So far from being removed from the temptations of intemperance, we shall, to say the least, be as much exposed to this curse to human society as we are now. The Indians that have settled on the south side of the Missouri and on the Kansas River, we are confident, instead of improving in civilized habits, good morals, or their condition being in any degree improved or ameliorated, have to the contrary retrograded, especially the Delawares from Indiana. In conclusion, your delegation must say that in all truth and sincerity, that they are decidedly of the opinion that the interests of the nation will not be promoted, nor their condition ameliorated by the removal from this to the country examined, and recommends to the chiefs and nation at large to cease all contention, bickerings, and party strifes, settle down, and maintain their position in the state of Ohio.
Having been outmaneuvered by the Wyandot in his attempts to remove them from Ohio, and knowing that the Wyandot occupied some of the best and most abundantly productive land in the entire state, the arrogant Gardiner responded with fury. Intent on removing the Wyandot to better his prospects of obtaining a more prestigious office with the Jackson administration, Gardiner went to the Wyandot living on the smaller Big Spring Reserve to the north of Upper Sandusky and convinced them to sell their 16,000-acre reserve to the United States without consulting their Wyandot brethren on the Grand Reserve, and without even allocating land west of the Mississippi to which the Wyandot of Big Spring could relocate.
Gardiner gets so mad, he goes up to the Big Spring Reserve, buys it out from under, writes a treaty with them. That's not as a developed country. The chiefs up there sign it. Walker is so furious, there's even talk we're going to execute all those people.
Walker and the other Wyandot leaders eventually relented and allowed the Wyandot of the Big Spring Reserve to live with them and use the money from the sale of Big Spring to make improvements on the Grand Reserve. They may have lost their Big Spring Reserve, but the Wyandot had learned two valuable lessons from their experience dealing with Gardiner.
But he learned something. He goes, wow, you know, one thing I learned about that negotiation with Gardiner, just keep delaying. Just keep talking. Fight him on every point. And he also realized, you know, if we have to, if we're running out of money, I can sell part of the Grand Reserve to get money for us to improve it. So that's what they try to do. They sell a strip of the Grand Reserve, and then they use that to continually improve their property. It's like, Jackson, we're not children in the forest. We are as sophisticated as you are.
The Wyandot had successfully thwarted the United States' first attempt to remove them from Ohio. But in January of 1834, in response to a petition from settlers in Northwest Ohio demanding that the Wyandot's Grand Reserve be opened for white settlement, the Ohio State Legislature passed a resolution requesting that the federal government make another attempt to negotiate a removal treaty with the tribe. Secretary of War Lewis Cass now appointed Robert Lucas, the Democratic governor of Ohio and a staunch Jackson supporter, as the commissioner responsible for negotiating a new removal treaty with the Wyandot. Lucas called for a council with the Wyandot in Upper Sandusky in the late summer of 1834 to begin the treaty negotiations. But the Wyandot still saw no reason to agree to leave their beloved Grand Reserve. Another Wyandot scouting party had just returned to Upper Sandusky from Kansas and corroborated William Walker Jr.'s earlier assessment that the land paled in comparison to Ohio and could not support the tribe. The Wyandot by now would have also surely known of the tragic misfortunes experienced by the Seneca and Shawnee during their removals to the West, and their leaders were determined not to allow a similar fate to befall their people.
They try again. Now it's Governor Lucas. Our county is named after him, Robert Lucas, big Jacksonian. He tells Jackson, I can do it. Goes up there, does the same thing. This time he lays out maps. He goes, look at the country, look at Kansas, look at how gorgeous it is. And they say to him, if it's so gorgeous, why don't you move there, Governor Lucas? You go. A young chief, his name is Samundawat. He appears like a traditionalist, but he's a Methodist, so he's hard to define. He stands up and he gives this amazing speech. He said, years ago, when we negotiated the peace treaty at the foot of the rapids, 1817, there was a young American who negotiated it, and he told us, once you sign this, don't you ever sell your land, don't you ever sell the Grand Reserve. He he was Lewis Cass, and he happens to be the Secretary of War of Andrew Jackson at this moment. So we're taking his advice, and there, that was done.
Though Ohio politicians and American Indian agents continued to exert pressure on them to sell their Grand Reserve and move west of the Mississippi, the Wyandot were able to continue resisting and delaying further removal attempts throughout the duration of Andrew Jackson's second term, as well as the single term of Jackson's successor as president, Martin Van Buren. While Van Buren had largely represented a continuation of Jackson's policies with respect to Indian removal, in 1840, he was defeated in his bid for re-election by none other than William Henry Harrison, the former commander of the Army of the Northwest, with whom the Wyandot had fought against Tecumseh's Confederacy in the War of 1812, and whom the Wyandot had always since considered a friend. Surely, they thought, Harrison would remember how valiantly the Wyandot had served alongside his army in the war, and would use the powers of his presidency to defend their right to forever remain in Ohio.
The tribe thought, if we can live past Jackson, if we can live past Van Buren, if William Henry Harrison is president, maybe because we fought with him in the War of 1812, he'll help us. Harrison said no. And that 1 month in office, he said, no, the tide has turned. It's time to go.
We'd sent multiple delegations to Washington to argue to stay, and pretty much every one of them was shut down.
And you could feel America moving towards the Civil War. It's like, we don't want to hear this Indian stuff anymore. Move on. We're going to fight slave or free.
In what must have seemed a grave betrayal to the Wyandot, Harrison didn't just refuse to renounce the United States Indian removal policy. As president, he was determined to succeed where his predecessors had failed in finally removing the Wyandot from Ohio. Before his unexpected death, just 1 month after assuming office, Harrison had appointed his old friend and fellow war veteran, John Johnston, as the commissioner responsible for negotiating a final removal treaty with the Wyandot. As a former Indian agent on the Ohio frontier, Johnston knew the Wyandot well and had also long been regarded by the tribe as a friend. He was intent on removing the Wyandot from Ohio, not just out of a sense of patriotic duty, but also, he believed, for the protection and survival of the great Indian nation for whom he had held a deep respect and admiration. In May of 1841, Johnston arrived among the Wyandot to begin the treaty negotiations, which the Wyandot were again determined to delay and resist.
John Johnston, who was the Indian agent out in western Ohio, he first tells Harrison and then Tyler, the president, I can get a deal. He had been a young guy in Wayne's army, just like Harrison was. He knew all the tribes. He knew Tecumseh. He knew everybody. And he came to the conclusion that if the Wyandot didn't get out of Ohio, it would be just like the fear of what was going to happen in Georgia, that the Georgians would overrun the Cherokee. He said, the American settlers will overrun you. Violence is coming your way. You've got to get out of here. He goes constantly, tries over and over. They won't listen to him. No, we're staying, we're staying, we're staying.
As Dr. Stockwell asserts, Johnston was moved by another impulse in his determination to remove the Wyandot from Ohio. Nostalgia. Whether consciously or not, like so many other American officials and war veterans of his generation who had living memory of a time when powerful Indian nations nearly brought down the United States and struck terror into the hearts of white settlers on the early western frontier, Johnston could not see past his nostalgia-laden memory that locked the Wyandot in a romanticized and perhaps even imaginary past, and could not accommodate the idea of indigenous peoples existing, let alone prospering, in a modern and industrialized American society. And the legacy of this romanticized perspective on indigeneity has persisted in American culture even into the present day, where it continues to influence and distort our understandings of the North American Indians.
I think Johnston had a nostalgia too. I want you guys to be in your buckskin and be like you're ready to fight with Tecumseh. And I come here and he goes, you appear more white than Indian. Well, you're all in an array of colors. I'm going, isn't that what we wanted? Aren't we supposed to get along together? Many of these young guys who had been in the army, they would look at the men who had changed so, and they wanted them to be warriors like Tecumseh. They didn't like them being behind the plow. I understand that. We're all very nostalgic about the Native Americans. We want them indigenous and locked in the past, and they weren't. They had to live in their present. And I would caution contemporary historians who are really nostalgic and really into this. We should have all remained separate forever. No, I don't think so. You don't have to necessarily see it that way, but you got to listen to these people themselves. What did they say? There were those like the prophet who said, "We don't like you. I still think Tecumseh's dream can come true. I'm going to Kansas," where he died in poverty. And then there were others like the great Wyandotte families who said, "E pluribus unum, aren't we all supposed to be in this mess together? And who knows what's coming down the road?" And that was half the battle, was how fast the tribes had changed overnight and accepted this offer that the U.S. government made them.
Through their attorney and tribal member John Armstrong, for months, the Wyandotte frustrated Johnston's continuing attempts to convince them to sign a removal treaty. Even when Johnston received approval from Thomas Hartley Crawford, the U.S. Commissioner of Indian Affairs under the new American President John Tyler, to offer a significant increase in the annuities and other forms of monetary and material support for the surrender of their land, the Wyandotte savvily countered with terms that demanded more in exchange for their removal, rightly asserting that the U.S. was undervaluing the true worth of their Ohio reserves. Meanwhile, internally, the Wyandotte remained deadlocked over the question of whether they should finally agree to enter into removal treaty negotiations. While many still favored leaving Ohio before the tribe found themselves completely overrun by the Americans, a slim majority still supported staying. For proponents of remaining on the Grand Reserve, not only was Ohio their people's rightful home, but the frenzy of increased migration and economic and industrial activity in Northwest Ohio was resulting in further increases in the value of the Wyandotte's land, and continuing to hold out on signing a removal treaty held the promise of realizing even greater compensation for the tribe if and when they did decide to negotiate a removal treaty. But in the end, it took a sudden tragic and catastrophic loss for the Wyandotte to finally change their mind.
Finally, in 1842, they take a vote and they decide to leave. I believe they left because Samundawat was murdered.
There were people that were very greedy for us to leave. Even one of our chiefs was killed, Samundawat.
This great young chief murdered when he was hunting in Henry County.
He was on his way back from, I think, a raccoon hunt. Two American guys showed up to his camp one night and they stayed the night. And he fed these guys and all that. Well, in the middle of the night, they killed him.
Two men killed him, killed his brother-in-law, and the wife of the brother-in-law ran for her life, but they caught her in the woods, killed her, stole all the furs, covered him up just with leaves.
Stole everything and took off.
Left them dead in the forest. They found the two fellows who did it.
They were captured, they were jailed, and then they walked.
They were put in a jail, and they were allowed to escape. John Johnston was so furious at this, he hunted one of the guys down, who had been then picked up for, I think, forgery. He was being held in the Perrysburg jail. Johnston comes and he begs the local officials in Perrysburg. He said, "This guy murdered Samundawat." They said, "We don't care." So they were never tried.
Because just an Indian, this is one of those Wyandotte guys. That's kind of the way it was done, reminiscent of all the racial things that happened in the Deep South. It was just a different environment and people's mindset.
Johnston just was horrified at that. But I cannot go down that street and see that jail and not think of that story. It's Samundawat and Johnston chasing this one guy down.
But that was one of those that just tore it and it was time to leave.
That shook them to the core. And that's when they finally said, maybe Johnston's right. Maybe after all we've done, the first wave coming our way will be violent and let's get out of here. And they signed a treaty with Johnston.
In March of 1842, fearing that the murder of Samundawat was only the beginning of a tide of violence coming their way, the chiefs of the Wyandotte Nation at last relented and entered into treaty negotiations with John Johnston to cede their lands in Upper Sandusky, their home for well over 100 years, to the United States, and to remove their people to new lands in Kansas. In the final treaty offered by Johnston, the U.S. pledged to fairly compensate the Wyandotte for all the improvements they had made to the Grand Reserve since the signing of the Treaty of Fort Meigs in 1817.
It guaranteed that they would be paid for the improvements on the land. They said, pay us for all our improvements, which was like over $100,000. That would be millions today. So they'd get over $100,000, and they could use that to buy land in the West, and they can use that to get ready to buy the equipment they needed to go West.
Johnston's treaty also pledged that the United States would provide the Wyandot with $500 a year for them to build and maintain a new school on their lands in Kansas, and that the land in Upper Sandusky, where the Wyandot's treasured mission church and tribal cemetery were located, would be excluded from the land cessions, guaranteeing that this ground, at least, would forever belong to the Wyandot.
They also said that they got the right to keep that little piece of Wyandot country, that church and the cemetery where so many are buried, like Catherine Rankin Walker. That's ours forever.
The Wyandot also successfully secured property guarantees for 24 specific tribal members named in the treaty, each of whom would receive 640 acres of land on the Wyandot's reserves in Kansas. To assist the tribe in relocating west of the Mississippi, Johnston offered that the U.S. would also pay the Wyandot an additional $10,000. But as for the removal process itself...
The amazing thing about them is they are going to move all on their own. Every other tribe got help from the U.S. government. People were hired to take them west, not these people. They say to the U.S. government, we're going on our own. Do not send a superintendent. Don't send a conductor like you did for the Shawnee and everybody else in the state. We go alone.
The Wyandot officially signed Johnston's removal treaty on March 17, 1842, and were granted 2 years to complete their relocation to Kansas. Having insisted on overseeing every aspect of the removal process themselves, Wyandot leaders began the arduous process of planning for their people's long journey west, determined that they would not suffer the same hardships and tragedies experienced by the Seneca and Shawnee during their grueling removals west a decade earlier. Rather than travel overland via wagon caravan all the way to Kansas, the Wyandot decided that they would travel west via steamboat on the Ohio, Mississippi, and Missouri rivers, and they planned to board the steamers at Cincinnati in the summer of 1843. Over the next year, the tribe carefully prepared for their journey, selling their personal property, such as farm equipment, furniture, and livestock, settling debts, arranging for receipt of the payments they were to receive from the U.S. government, procuring passage on the steamboats the Nottoway and the Republic, preparing the wagons by which they would transport their property and equipment, as well as the vulnerable members of the tribe unable to walk long distances on the overland portions of the journey, and arranging for the transportation of the tribe's horses. The Wyandot had no intention of saying goodbye to their beloved horses, as the Seneca had been unexpectedly forced to do during their removal. Rather, several young Wyandot men, led by Matthew Walker, a brother of William Walker Jr., would be responsible for taking the tribe's horses overland from Ohio to Kansas.
They spent a year getting ready, selling off their property. They have buggies, they buy wagons, they get their big horse herd together. Young men are going to take that west and walk them out through Indiana.
American officials in communication with the Wyandot throughout the removal process marveled at how calmly and even cheerfully the tribe went about their preparations and at how efficiently they had conducted all the necessary arrangements for the journey. But an unexpected complication arose when, as the date of their departure drew closer, the Wyandot suddenly found themselves without a home in Kansas on which to settle. While they had originally arranged to purchase land south of the Kansas River from the Shawnee, in the spring of 1843, the Shawnee withdrew their offer to sell them a portion of their Kansas reserve.
They say to the U.S. government, we will go, we will find the land ourselves. They thought they would buy it from the Shawnee, but the Shawnee reneged, and then the Wyandot, they know their whole history. We allowed you to come to live in Ohio, and now you won't sell us land in Kansas.
The Shawnee had agreed to give us land. Hey, you let us live with you. Well, right before we moved, they said, no, we can't do it. Because the government basically said no.
Faced with a crisis that threatened to derail all their meticulously laid preparations for their journey west, in May of 1843, Wyandot chiefs had no choice but to send a scouting party ahead of the rest of the tribe to find a suitable place in Kansas for their people to live, and to set up a store in Westport, Missouri, where the tribe would be able to procure needed goods and supplies immediately upon disembarking the steamboats. In their report back to the Wyandot chiefs, the scouting party recommended that the tribe settle near the juncture of the Kansas and Missouri rivers. Still unsure exactly where they would be living, in July of 1843, In the final days leading up to their departure for Cincinnati, the Wyandot commenced the last of their preparations, including compiling the muster roll, naming every member of the tribe who would be embarking on the tribe's westward journey. The final muster roll included 609 individuals from the Wyandot of Ohio, as well as 55 Wyandot from the Huron River Valley in Michigan, and another 30 Wyandot from Canada, who would be joining their Ohio brethren for the journey to Kansas. Among the Ohio Wyandot named on the muster roll were surviving revered chiefs such as Squire Grey Eyes and Mononcue, powerful spiritual leaders who had helped lead their people out of great hardship and destitution following the War of 1812, as well as the members of some of the Wyandot's most influential families, such as the Walkers, the Armstrongs, and the Zanes, whose ranks included many white tribal members through marriage or adoption. Among the Wyandot's final acts before departing for the steamboats docked at Cincinnati was bidding farewell to their many friends from neighboring white communities in Northwest Ohio. Despite the changing political tides in America unleashed by Jacksonian nationalism that had shifted public sentiment prevalently in favor of Indian removal since the passing of the Indian Removal Act, there were still many Ohioans who had vehemently opposed the forced removals of the Indian nations who had inhabited their land long before it had come to be known as the State of Ohio, and who protested for the tribe's ancestral rights to remain on their reserves in Northwest Ohio that the United States had promised in the Treaty of Fort Meigs would belong to them forever. But in the end, the ideology of manifest destiny had eclipsed the hopeful vision that had once been foundational to the Indian policy of America's founding generation, that white settlers and native peoples might dwell in peace together and one day unite under a shared national identity. For the Indian nations of Northwest Ohio, it had become all too clear that the cost of that national identity would be the loss of the ancestral cultures and traditions that had been the lifeblood of their peoples for thousands of years, and that removing west of the Mississippi, beyond the official boundaries of the United States, was the best hope they had of ensuring that their indigenous identities would endure into future generations. Now, as the last of their Indian neighbors, the Wyandot, prepared to leave Northwest Ohio, distraught American settlers, many of whom had never known a time when the Wyandot were not an integral part of their community, flooded onto the Grand Reserve to bid their goodbyes to a venerated and resilient Indian nation who, having once fiercely resisted the American invasion of their homelands generations earlier, had suffered greatly in their eventual defeat, only to emerge from the brink of decimation to achieve an extraordinary cultural and spiritual renewal, to embrace their white neighbors while remaining a culturally distinct people, and to become a remarkably prosperous nation who helped shape the course of American life in Northwest Ohio.
I must say I was very proud of Ohio, because the Ohioans was like, we're going to give this land. We're going to defend you to the bitter end.
There was a segment of the community that were just horrified that we'd left. I mean, just absolutely mortified. It's like, why would they do that? They're part of the town.
And even when they were sent west, people in Upper Sandusky, the American settlers and citizens, were distraught. They came to this church, Little Wyandot Mission. The U.S. government built that for the Wyandot. And the settlers crowded in, everybody weeping, don't go, don't go.
Ohio was the last place we wanted to be. We chose to be there, not somewhere else. So it was a very hard decision. I mean, when these people, they're wearing Western clothing and they deal with all these people and they're part of the town, it's like, why would you? Why would we want to leave? We're prosperous here. And then there were others sitting there going, we get their land. They got to get rid of it so we can buy it cheap.
A History of Wyandot County, published in 1884, contains a description of the Wyandot's final gatherings with their white neighbors on the Grand Reserve that poignantly captures the feelings of solemnity, sorrow, and grief that pervaded the Wyandot's farewell to Upper Sandusky.
The parting scenes at Upper Sandusky were most affecting. Consultations were held in the council house and religious worship in the church, almost constantly for days before the final departure. Meanwhile, the remains of the chief, Sumandawut, who was murdered by two white men in the fall of 1841, also those of the colored preacher, John Stewart, were brought hither and deposited in the burial ground attached to their church. The last resting places of other loved ones were likewise tenderly cared for and marked with stone or marble tablets. Just before their strange and motley procession unwound its length on the highway leading southerly, Squire Greyeyes bade an affectionate farewell to the large number of whites present. He exhorted them to be good Christians and to meet him in heaven. In a most sublime and pathetic manner, he discoursed upon all the familiar objects of a home no longer theirs. He bade adieu to the Sandusky, on whose waters they had paddled the light bark canoe, and in whose pools they had fished, laved, and sported. He saluted in his farewell the forests and the plains of Sandusky, where he and his ancestors had hunted, roved, and dwelt for many generations. He bade farewell to their habitations, where they had dwelt for many years, and where they would still wish to dwell. With mournful strains and plaintive voice, he bade farewell to the graves of his ancestors, which now they were about to leave forever, probably to be encroached upon, ere the lapse of many years, by the avaricious tillage of some irreverent white man. As a Christian, he closed his valedictory by alluding to an object yet dearer to him. It was the church where they had worshipped, the temple of God, constructed by the good white men for their use, and within whose walls they had so often bowed down in reverence under the ministrations of Finley and his co-laborers.
Of all the Indian nations of Ohio, it is the Wyandot whose story most compellingly challenges and complicates conventional assumptions and simplified narratives about the history of American and indigenous interactions on the Ohio frontier. While this history was certainly defined by war and conquest, greed, exploitation, dispossession, and, ultimately, ethnic cleansing, the Wyandot story shows us how it was also defined just as much by native resistance and sovereignty, and negotiation, exchange, coexistence, and even kinship among native peoples and American settlers. The removal of the Ohio Indians was the tragic consequence of broader political and societal forces playing out at the national level over a period of 50 years, as the young United States expanded its continental dominion west to the Mississippi River and even beyond, and as the founding generation's idealized and albeit flawed vision of peacefully incorporating Native peoples into American society gradually gave way to the more aggressively nationalistic populism of the Jacksonian age that fueled the rise of the ideology of manifest destiny and demanded the forced removal of indigenous peoples from American territory. The decades following the signing of the Treaty of Fort Meigs in 1817 provide us with a glimpse, however fleeting or even unlikely, into how things could have gone differently in Northwest Ohio. Out of the devastation they suffered from the War of 1812, most Ohio tribes were able to recover a sense of stability and cohesion on the reserves carved out for them in the treaty, and even, in the case of the Wyandot, to achieve a renewal and prosperity that far transcended the demands the treaty had imposed upon them. And as the Wyandot story shows us, the treaty also provided a legal blueprint by which the Ohio tribes could resist a growing chorus of calls for their removal and assert their tribal agency and sovereignty in the midst of the chaotic and turbulent waves of white settlement that increasingly surrounded their reserves and transformed a Northwest Ohio landscape in the early 19th century. And while a growing contingent of Ohioans eagerly called for the removal of the tribes, just as many, from ordinary farmers to politicians at the local, state, and national levels, fervently opposed it and fought for the rights of the tribes to forever remain on the land reserves promised to them by the Treaty of Fort Meigs. Yet other white Ohioans even became members of the tribes themselves through marriage or adoption. Observers noted how by the time the Wyandots signed the treaty that removed them from Ohio, they presented outwardly as wealthy white farmers every bit as much as they did traditionally indigenous people. And yet they were all Wyandot. For a brief historical moment, Northwest Ohio, and especially the Wyandot's home of Upper Sandusky, was a nexus point for the cultural, social, and economic interactions and exchanges between indigenous peoples and white settlers that America's founding generation, from the presidencies of George Washington to James Monroe, had hoped would eventually lead to the merging of white and native peoples under one shared national identity. And no tribe exemplified the intersection and concurrence of indigenous and Anglo-American lifeways more than the Wyandot. So successful had the Wyandot become on their Grand Reserve that at one time they seemed to be the very anchor of American civilization in Northwest Ohio. that this remarkable chapter in Ohio's history eventually unraveled, that in the end, Ohio betrayed the promise of the Treaty of Fort Meigs that some of the Ohio tribes endeavored so hard to fulfill so their people might forever remain on their cherished homelands, and that the great tribal nations of Ohio were ultimately forcibly removed from the lands where they had dwelt for well over 100 years, is one of the gravest legacies of dishonor in Ohio's history. And as inheritors of this history, we Ohioans of today are left to wrestle with the question we had posed at the beginning of part one of this series. Knowing the broader history of the United States' treatment of indigenous peoples as we now do, was the forced removal of Ohio's Indian nations always inevitable? Or could Ohio have been different? Could things ever have been otherwise?
I had the great good fortune of meeting the Wyandotte of Kansas. I was at the Kansas Book Festival. So I met descendants of Catherine Walker and the Zanes and the Armstrongs. And so that was great fun. And I said, "You come from spectacular people." And they, of course, knew all that. But, but I told them, I think they could have stayed. I think it could have been otherwise. I still think they had the wherewithal, the legal minds, the legal knowledge to fight this in the courts. I think they could have stayed. Other tribes like the Seneca in Western New York, they fought it all the way up to the Supreme Court. Tonawanda is still there. I said, I think you guys could have stayed. And if nothing else and you had been overrun, I still wish you had stayed in Ohio. And you'd be here like you're descendants of the Wyandotte, like I'm Irish and all these other things. And I don't know what would have happened if they had stayed, if they had been able to completely hold on to that tribal identity. Maybe the reservation would have been broken apart and they would have been individual landowners and maybe eventually granted some kind of Ohio citizenship. To me, that's the missing element in all this. Why aren't they American citizens?
Well, natives are natives. Thank you, Andy Jackson. So we were removed, and basically the government got what it wanted at the time. They wanted rid of us. That's just the way it was. Unfortunately, it's a horrible chapter in American history.
Ohio's loss is Kansas's gain, I always felt.
In the fifth and final part of this series on the history of the Wyandotte in Ohio.
On July 7, 1843, they come down to Cincinnati.
The Wyandotte bid farewell to their beloved Ohio and depart for their new home in Kansas.
They buy the tickets on the steamboat. They get on the steamboats. They go out to Westport, Missouri.
After an inauspicious arrival in Kansas and months spent at the temporary site picked out by their scouting party, the Wyandotte eventually purchase lands from their friends, the Delaware, which they transform into a burgeoning agricultural settlement that would eventually go on to become Kansas City, Kansas.
The Delaware said, "Here's land. We'll sell it to you." That's how we got land in Kansas. We'd been promised land, and we get there, and there's nothing. We get dumped on the wrong side of the river on a mud flat.
They get wagons. And they go out, and overnight, Kansas City, Kansas is born because the Wyandotte are there.
But even as some prominent members of the Wyandotte become increasingly influential figures on the national political stage,
William Walker Jr. was the first territorial governor of Nebraska Territory, which was Kansas and Nebraska. First one. He's a native.
The ensuing decades proved to be a period of yet more drastic change and consequential upheaval for the Wyandotte and other Eastern Indian nations who had been forced west to Kansas and Oklahoma.
Once they get to Kansas, Walker's prediction is true, that the war begins and trouble begins.
Treaties were not honored. The Treaty of 1842, whenever we agreed to leave, the government didn't come through for them.
Within just a decade of the Wyandotte's removal from Ohio, the United States again betrays the promises it had made to the Wyandotte in their 1842 removal treaty. The Kansas-Nebraska Act of 1854 thrusts Kansas into the country's intensifying fight over the expansion of slavery, and the territory erupts in a series of violent conflicts between pro- and anti-slavery forces, now known as Bleeding Kansas. Meanwhile, new waves of American land speculators, gold prospectors, pioneer settlers, and railroad companies flood through the Indians' Kansas territory, driving America's unrelenting expansion to the west coast of the North American continent. Again, the American government enacts new treaties with the Wyandotte and several other tribes in Kansas, in which the United States takes possession of vast amounts of land that had been promised as Indian reserves. And the question of American citizenship now emerges as a cultural fault line that causes divisions within many tribes, including the Wyandot, as many Wyandot of Kansas are persuaded to accept American citizenship and private plots of land in exchange for their tribal reserves.
Lewis Cass told William Walker Jr., Kansas is going to be a native state. It'll be run by natives, but you got to become citizens. They started that whole citizenship thing, but William Walker Jr. bought into it. He convinced a lot of these people to take U.S. citizenship.
And most of the Wyandot became citizens of Kansas, and they got their property to them through that, and then quickly they were citizens of the U.S.
While other members of the Wyandot, wishing to retain their tribal identity, moved to Indian Territory in northeastern Oklahoma and settle on small reserves.
Well, if they don't want to be citizens, then they can go to Indian Territory. This started about 1855. People were like, okay, this is not going the way we wanted. They would petition the Indian Party and say, hey, we want to come to Oklahoma. And especially my family, about 1874, when William Walker Jr. died, his nephew, Isaiah, they came down here. It was like, if you want to stay tribal, you will go to Indian Territory. So some stayed. It's like, we just got our lives back. Why would I want to go? So I don't blame anybody's ancestors stayed in Kansas. I get it.
It is the descendants of those Wyandot who relocated to Oklahoma to preserve their tribal sovereignty, who in the 20th century go on to achieve federal recognition as the Wyandot Nation of Oklahoma. And in the 21st century, to bring forth a new era of cultural renewal for the tribe, as Lifeway researchers such as Chris Houck dedicate themselves to reconnecting the Wyandot community to the ancient traditions of their ancestors.
I am the Lifeways researcher. That is my job, is trying to bring these things back. And I have learned so much.
From the Wyandot language.
We're reawakening our language. It's not dead, it was just sleeping.
To songs.
We started a singing group here about 2 years ago. I've been singing for 3 years. So now we have about a dozen different people that all get together every Thursday night and we sing for 2 hours. We sing the songs. We actually have our songs. They're no one else's. And we talk about important things, a lot of the language and different speeches, like we introduce our social songs in our language, talk about the earth songs of our people and the Wyandot ways and how important they are. So it's a lot of fun.
To spirituality.
Religion among the Wyandot since antiquity is not a religion per se. You didn't go to worship at a certain time. It was every day. It was part of culture, part of who you are. Everything had a spirit.
To food ways.
Until a couple of years ago, it had been 179 years since the Wyandot, as a people, have gathered sap and boiled syrup and all that. We were brought back into it with the Eastern Shawnees, our neighbors to the east and north. They helped us get back into it, which is always a great time.
To material culture.
Just making things. I've made bows, and I've gone out and I've harvested wild rose shoots and things and hazel and made arrows out of them. We have guys, they're making their own water drums now. Even rattles, our headdresses we make, and moccasins, and so much. That's what the cultural center here is all about, is bringing these things back, getting these things back to the people, get them back in their hands. There are those of us that are learning those old ways. It's very important to not forget them.
And to the Wyandot's enduring connection to their ancestral homelands, now known as the state of Ohio.
A lot of people are starting to feel that connection back to Ohio. Upper Sandusky's home. It's hard to explain. It feels right. It is nice to go up and let people see, just to feel the presence of the ancestors. I can go to some of my great grandparents, visit their graves, and know that they were here. They were real people. But it's a place that's in our heart. It's in our minds. When you're there, to me, it fills my heart. It makes my heart full. It's a good place to return to. You know where you belong.
And we'll join the Wyandot on two recent visits the tribe made back to Ohio, when many Wyandot families again walked upon Ohio ground for the first time in generations. And Upper Sandusky rang out once again with sounds that hadn't been heard here for hundreds of years. Great thanks to our guest experts for this episode of Storied Ground, Ohio historian Mary Stockwell and Lifeways researcher for the Wyandotte Nation of Oklahoma, Chris Houck. And thank you to our voice actors for this episode, including Lane Hawkle, Samantha Heater, Dylan Sickles, and, from the Wyandotte Nation of Oklahoma, Chris Houck. I'm your host and producer, Nick Pavlik. Our executive producer is Chris Pfeiffer. If you have any questions, comments, or you want to listen again, go to wgte.org/ground or wherever you stream your podcasts. See you next time.
WGTE. Voices around us.